We're just talking here about the relation between prophecy, that is, the message of the prophet, and Nabi, the prophet. And what I'm saying is, the two are very closely connected. The words of the prophets, if you call them a prophecy, are really words of God. And it may or may not be predicted. In other words, a prophecy is a word from God through the instrumentality of the Nabi. And as some of those citations pointed out, with the Greek prophetes, it's really speaking for God. It's not so much the essence of the meaning of words, not so much foretelling as it is forthtelling. That forthtelling may include prediction, but prediction is not the essence of what prophecy is. Absolutely. All right, let's go on to another term, and that is roeth. As you see the word there in your outline, it's really a participial form of ra'ah to see. And it's often translated seer. Now, as soon as you come to that term, and look at the literature on it, you'll find that there are those who attempt to argue that Navi and Roeth were originally two different types of people. In other words, you could distinguish between a Roeth and a Navi, and that it was only in later time that the two words became more synonymous. One scholar, his name is not that important, but I'll give it to you, Alfred Haldar, Haldar, argued that you find the same difference in some Mesopotamian language designating, quote, prophets, as you find in the Old Testament. And in Mesopotamia, you have, what I did with my, you have some people that are called Mahu and Baru. And what Haldar argued was that the Mahu was the same as the Hebrew Navi, and the Baru was the same as the Hebrew Roeth. So we have these two designations in Akkadian, Mesopotamian texts. And he said the equivalent in Israel is in the Mahu and the Babi and the Navi and the Baru and the Roeth. Now, in Mesopotamian usage, that Mahu and Baru were similar in that both of them had the task of discerning what the will of God was and then making that known to other people. But there was an important difference between the Mahu and the Baru. The Mahu received the message from the gods directly. And he did so in an ecstatic condition. So the Mahu was an ecstatic. And while he's in that ecstatic condition, he gets a message from a deity, which he then transfers on to others. And he does that while he's still in the ecstatic frame of mind. The Baru, however, was different. The Baru received the message indirectly.
through external means.
In other words, the Baru was someone who would read astrological signs or read omens of various sorts. One of the ways in which the Baru determined the will of the Lord was to examine the livers of sacrificial animals. And if you look at the configuration of the liver, different configurations of livers would have different significances. And he would, by that way, determine the will of God. Or pour oil out on water and see what kind of pattern develops from that and read something from that. Or cast lots, various means of, external means of determining the will of God. Now, what Holder tries to do then is say that just as Mesopotamia had their ecstatics and their Baru priests, the same distinction in Israel is to be found between the Navi and the Rohan. The Navi was the ecstatic who received this message directly from the deity. The Rohan was someone who received information externally and then passed it on to others. Now, that's an interesting theory. The problem is, if you look at biblical data, it becomes quite clear biblical data don't fit the pattern. Here you get a pattern from elsewhere and try to impose it on Scripture and force the specifics of scriptural data into the already preconceived pattern. For example, Samuel is called a seer, 1 Samuel 9:11. But he did not work with external means in order to determine the will of God. Now let me just say something further about this business of determining the will of God by external means before we go further. That is not completely excluded in the Bible. Remember the high priest had the Urim and the Thummim in his role, and he could determine the will of God through use of the Urim and the Thummim. When you get in time of David, and after Saul had wiped out the priests at Nob, Abiathar escaped and he brought the ephod to David, and in the next few chapters you see David saying, "Bring me the ephod." And then he asked questions of the Lord, "Shall I go to this place or not?" And the Lord says, "Yes, go." "Will I be victorious?" And the Lord says, "Yes, you will." "No, you won't." So forth. So if there was the use of external means in biblical, in a legitimate way, in the biblical material. However, that individual who used the external means is never called a ruler. Abiathar, who had the custody, you might say, of that Urim and Thummim, he was a priest. He wasn't a ruler. So it doesn't fit the category. You do have reference to individuals who use external phenomena to determine the will of God. But the interesting thing is, they're never called seers. They're never designated by the term ruach. They are called diviners or soothsayers or sorcerers. And if you look at that Deuteronomy 18:10 passage, or Deuteronomy 18 generally, but look at verse 10, in that very same passage which describes what the prophet is to be and how God is going to speak through the prophet, you read in verse 10 of that passage, Deuteronomy 18:10, let no one be found among you who sacrifices his son or daughter in the fire, who practices divination or sorcery, interprets omens, engages in witchcraft or casts spells, who is a medium, a spiritist, who consults the dead. Anyone who does these things is detestable to the Lord. In other words, doing what the very thing that these Baal priests did in Mesopotamia, looking at omens from livers or from astrological phenomena or whatever, is something that was forbidden to the Israelites. Now, there's a verse that I think is instructive, although it's also a verse that has a lot of raises a lot of questions. But a verse that is instructive regarding the question of the relationship between the usage of Roeh and Na'vi in the Old Testament is 1 Samuel 9, verse 9. First Samuel 9, verse 9 reads, formerly in Israel, if a man went to inquire of God, he would say, come, let us go to the seer, the Roeh. Because the prophet of today used to be called a seer. The Na'vi of today used to be called a Roeh. Now that verse, if you're looking at the NIV, you will see it's in parentheses. It's a parenthetical statement that is inserted after verse 8. If you look at the larger context, I think you would conclude that it really fits better after verse 11 than it does after verse 8. You see, this is where Saul is out hunting for his father's lost cattle, and they can't find it, and his servant says, there's this seer, why don't we go and ask him? And he says that in verse 8, the servant said, look, I have a quarter of a shekel of silver. I'll give it to the man of God so that he will tell us what way to take. Leave verse 9 out for the moment. Good, Saul said to his servant. Let's go. So they set out for the town where the man of God was. As they were going up to the hill to the town, they met some girls coming out to draw water. And they asked him, is the seer here? And there you get the use of the word Roeh. Is the seer here? And you see, verse 9 then, if you put it down there after verse 11, formerly in Israel, if a man went to inquire of God, he would say, come, let's go to seer, because the prophet of today used to be called a seer. Now, what many people think is that verse 9 was not part of the original text. It was an explanatory gloss, probably in the margin of the text, that at some point in the process of transmission, got put into the text, but put in really in the wrong place. It should have been put in after verse 11 to explain what a seer is, rather than after verse 8, where it really doesn't fit so well. Well, I think it's reasonable to conclude that it probably is an explanatory gloss, not part of the original text. But the important thing that it is telling us is there's no essential difference between a prophet and a seer. It's a matter of linguistic usage. The prophet of today used to be called a seer. The word seer is older than prophet. And in later times, when the prophet, the word Navi was the more common term, and the word seer became rather archaic language, you needed this explanation so there'd be no confusion. Well, I think that's probably what's going on here. But if you think about it and put it in its larger biblical context, it raises some other questions. When do we date this remark? And that question becomes rather significant because a long time after Samuel, prophets were still called seers. You find it in Isaiah, for example, the use of the term seer. And also perplexing is that the term Navi is used long before the time of Samuel. Abraham was called a Navi. Go back to Genesis 20, verse 7. And Navi is used in Numbers, it's used in Deuteronomy, it's used in Judges. In fact, Samuel himself is called a Navi. Look at 1 Samuel 3:20. So then the question becomes, if the word prophet is used before the time of Samuel, how can it be said that what was later termed a prophet was in the time of Samuel called a seer? Now some people might say, oh, and some people have, here's a clear evidence that all the texts in the Old Testament in which the word prophet is used are to be dated long after the time of Samuel. Well, is that a legitimate conclusion? Let's go to the Hebrew text. See, the Hebrew reads Ki Lanavi Hayom Yikare Yifanim Haroeh. For the prophet of today, Yikare, was called Yifanim, formerly Basir. Now, translation of that is a bit difficult. Notice what the NIV does, because the prophet of today, Lanavim, takes that kind of in a construct with Hayom, the prophet of today, used to be called a seer. King James and NASB repeat the verb. For he that is now called the prophet, or the prophet of today, was called formerly a seer. He that is now called the prophet, before time was called a seer. You only have one verb in the Hebrew expression. NASB says he is called the prophet, now he's formerly called a seer. Now, if you go to the Septuagint translation of 1 Samuel 9:1, there you get a different idea introduced. Because there you have, for the people before time called the prophet the seer. See, hatiton prope kain ekale haleos. Where's that haleos come from? The people before time called the prophet the seer. Go back to the Hebrew. You see the hayon there? What the Septuagint translation presupposes in the Hebrew is instead of Hayom, you would have had Ha'am. See how easily that could be confused? The yod and the wow and the ayin. I think that the Septuagint probably puts the correct light on what's going on here. The difference between the reading of the Septuagint and the Masoretic text is that the Septuagint indicates that Roeh was a more popular designation for people, whereas Navi was more technical or official word for prophet. The people formerly called the prophet the seer. And if that's the case, the word Roeh could continue in use in later times, and the term prophet could have been used earlier, as we actually find it. And there's no essential difference between the two. It's a distinction between more technical and more popular usage, not an absolute distinction. So the prophets were seers. They were made to see by God what they should proclaim to others. So even though the words Navi and Roeh are both used, I think we can say they speak of the same function. The prophet, the people called the prophet the seer formally. Now, if you're going to make a distinction between them, I think that to this degree it's legitimate to say that Navi shows us a person who is, you might say, turned toward the people to speak God's message, so that the emphasis is on what he has received from God. The Roeh shows the person turned to God. In other words, the Navi, the emphasis is more on the proclamation. The Roeh is more on the emphasis on receiving the message, seeing the message. So you could say the Navi puts more stress on the active function of proclamation, while the Roeh puts more stress on the passive function of receiving the message. But no essential difference between the prophet and the seer. Any question or comment? Let's go on to Hosea. Oh, I'm sorry. I looked down. Yes, go ahead.
Then how would a seer that, you know, the ones that are being asked by a king to, you know, come in, like read the writing on the wall or whatever, interpret dreams and so forth, you know, stuff like that. I mean, how do they not get confused?
Well, I think what you're getting at there is this question of how to distinguish between the true and false prophet, or not. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if the people are calling, Isaiah or, you know, Obadiah or something, if they're just using the term seer, then how would they distinguish, you know, that the actual prophets then from, you know, somebody else if they call them a seer? Or where they call the seer?
Yes, in fact, if you look at, let me see here if I have a reference, in this would work well. Look at Isaiah 6:1. In 6:1, Isaiah says, "Near the king Uzziah died, I saw the Lord." There you have the verbal form, Ra'ah. So, you know, Isaiah had a visionary experience of God. He saw the Lord. He could legitimately be called a Roeh, as well as a Navi. I think the emphasis of that term, Ra'ah, Roeh, is on this visionary means of receiving the message. whereas the emphasis of the term Navi is more on the proclamation of the message to others. But a Rohan and a Navi are the same thing. It's just a different designation, and there seemed to be a preference among the people for using the term Rohan earlier and Navi later, as far as popular versus technical kind of label for the people who are performing this function. But there's no reason biblically to see any distinction. If let me see in Amos 1:1, what's that say? I was looking for Roa, but it's verbal instead of noun. The words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, what he saw concerning Israel 2 years before the earthquake. If this is the words of Amos, you would expect in the way we talk for the following phrase to read, the words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, what he heard concerning Israel 2 years before his flood. It doesn't say that. It says what he saw. It's on that visionary kind of reception. Now, I'm not sure whether that's Rohat or Hosat or Haza or Raha. Let me just check that. Let's see. No, it's Haza. It's this next word we're looking at, which he saw, Haza. But it's the same thing. It means to see, to gaze at, Haza. So, yeah, I think the important thing here is there's no, this kind of a attempt to separate the Navi from the Roa as being two different kinds of individuals. It's not legitimate on the biblical text. We're the same.
But somebody that just worked for the king knows wasn't considered a prophet, but was, you know, a fortune teller or just predicted the future. Were they also called a seer?
No, they'd be called soothsayers, diviners, readers of omens. There are other words for those kinds of individuals. Yeah. Okay? All right, let's go on to Hosea. I won't say much about that. It comes from Hadadah, it's just like Roa comes from Raha. And Hosea means to gaze at or look at. And it's really a synonym or an equivalent for Roa. And it's used in the same way. And I would say here, just as with Roa, the emphasis seems to be on receiving the revelation of God. So if you look at Isaiah 1:1, we just noticed that name is 1:1. But Isaiah 1:1, the vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah son of Amos saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. The vision is Hazon. That's the Pet, Zion, Nun. It's a noun derived from Chazah. The vision that Isaiah saw, and that's Chazah. So you could call Isaiah a Hosea, as well as a Navi, or a Roa. I mean, all these terms are used interchangeable. All right, any other question on this to get on to something else? Yeah.
I have a question on the meaning of indirectly.
And yeah.
That means there's someone between God and the Aru, or just that they generate a message from God from any kind of a...
They use external means to determine the message from God. In other words, they use examination of livers.
Circumstance or phenomena about nature.
Pardon?
They used to get a message from God to see the kind of the picture of nature or some phenomena of a circumstance.
Yeah, they would use phenomena, observable phenomena, and from that read a message from God. Whereas the Mahu would receive the message directly without any external means to convey the message, and he would receive that directly while he was in this ecstatic condition. Okay, let's go on to three. The origin of prophetism in Israel, and you notice there are three subpoints. A is alleged analogies to Israel's prophetism in other nations. B is internal Israelite explanations for the origin of prophetism. And C is what I think is a biblical explanation of the origin of prophetism. So first, we're going to spend more time on A than on 3 and 4. Or on A than we are on B and C. But A is alleged analogies to Israel's prophetism in other nations or among other people. You'll find in the literature that it's often said that analogies can be found to prophetism in Israel among other peoples, nations, in the ancient Near East. And then what usually happens is scholars attempt to explain the phenomena of prophetism in Israel as being a derivative of these phenomena outside of Israel. So that the origin of Israel's prophets is attributed to or explained by analogous phenomena that are found outside of Israel. Now, a few comments on this. I think that from the outset, we have to be honest and clear and open and say that we cannot deny that we may come across what I would call formal similarities between what we find in Israel and the phenomena of prophetism elsewhere. Formal similarities. And in fact, when you think about it, there are a lot of customs, religious institutions and practices in Israel that have formal analogies among other people. But I'm not sure saying that says a whole lot. Even if there are formal similarities, the question is, does that give a basis for saying there's some kind of intrinsic connection or link between what we find in Israel and among the surrounding nations? It seems to me, in view of what we've already said about the nature of the prophetic function in Israel, that if these are people chosen by God, through whom he will give his word to his people by putting his word in their mouth, to speak of any kind of intrinsic link between what goes on in Israel and what we may find among other peoples, would have to be something that would be highly questioned. And it would seem to me that speak of derivation is something that would be excluded on the basis of the data we find in Scripture. But having said that, it's also very clear that God speaks to human beings, including to his people, Israel, in the Old Testament period. He speaks to them in the context of the culture, the institutions, the thought forms of the people to whom he is speaking. And when you look at the Old Testament, you will find many phenomena in the Old Testament for which you can find formal analogies outside of Israel. The Old Testament is full of regulations for bringing sacrifice. Well, other ancient peoples used sacrifices in their religious observance. the Old Testament sign of the covenant was circumcision. Other ancient peoples practiced circumcision. Circumcision acquired a very specific and unique significance or meaning in the context of the Old Testament, but it was not something unknown in the ancient world. Think of the whole concept of covenant that seems quite clearly to have been molded on a concept of treaty that governed international relations, the Hittite treaty form, where biblical covenant form is molded on the Hittite treaty form. So God takes an instrument of human legal relationships and utilizes it to structure the relationship which he establishes between himself and his people as the great king. Or just take the idea of kingship. No. Israel, at a certain point in time, wasn't satisfied with God as their king. They wanted a human king, like the nations round about. Well, the Lord told Samuel, give them a king. So Israel had a king, like the nations round about. However, with the qualification, when God told Samuel to give him a king, Samuel described the manner of the kingship, 1 Samuel 10:25. So the role and function of the king in Israel was quite different from that of the nations round about. So you have similarity and difference. Yeah, Israel had a king, but it wasn't a king who functioned in the same way that kings outside of Israel did. Israel had a priest. Other ancient peoples had priests. So why should not Israel have a prophet and other ancient peoples have prophets, but with essential differences between the way in which the prophet functioned in Israel and the way in which the prophet functioned outside of Israel. So if you can find outside of Israel a formal, I'm saying formal analogy to what you find in Israel with respect to the prophetic function, I don't think that detracts in any way from the uniqueness of Israel's prophets. Yes, other people had prophets. But in Israel, there's something different. And the most essential characteristic of prophetism in Israel is that in Israel, the prophet doesn't speak his own ideas. He doesn't give his own words. He gives a message given to him directly by the one and only true God. So when you ask the question about analogies to prophetism outside of Israel with what you find in Israel, I think you have to keep all that in mind. But even having said that, I think then the next question becomes, what kind of evidence is there for even some kind of formal analogy to prophetism outside of Israel? If it's not in its essence, in its intrinsic quality, is God placing his words in the mouth of these individuals. What kind of formal evidence do you find in the ancient world for this phenomenon of prophetism? And you notice on your outline, I have Mesopotamian analogies and Egyptian analogies, Canaanite analogies, and the conclusion. I meant to hand these sheets out at the break and I forgot, so we're going to do it now. First is Mesopotamian analogies. The most important extra-biblical texts for Mesopotamian analogies are texts that were found at a place called Mari, which is in the vicinity of Babylon in upper Mesopotamia. It was a prosperous city before the time of Hammurabi. Hammurabi's about 1700, so it's fairly early. The ruler there, in the time just before it fell to Hammurabi. Hammurabi conquered Mari, was a ruler known as Zimri Lim. You'll see his name in these texts. There have been about 5,000 cuneiform tablets found in an archive in the excavations of Mari. And among them, some find traces of what they call prophetism in Mesopotamia. If you look at letter in that handout, if you look at A, the first text there, under Akkadian letters, notice the heading Divine Revelations. This material is taken out of ancient Near Eastern texts, AMNT, standard English language translation of extra-biblical text edited by Pritchard, published by Princeton University Press. That's all in the bibliography. The first text there is a letter of Ittur Asdu to Zimri Lim, who was the king of Mari. And let me read the text. It's not that long. Let me make some comments on it. It reads, "Speak to my lord, thus Ittur Asdu, your servant. The day I dispatched this tablet of mine to my lord, Malik Dagon, a man from Shaka, came and spoke to me as follows. In a dream of mine, I was set on going in the company of another man from the fortress of Sagaratum in the upper district to Mari. On my way, I entered Kirta. And right after entering, I entered the temple of Dagon and prostrated myself. As I was prostrate, Dagon opened his mouth and spoke to me as follows. Did the kings of the Ammonites and their forces make peace with the forces of Zimri Lim, who moved up here? I said they did not make peace. Just before I went out, he spoke to me as follows. Why are the messengers of Zimri Lim not in constant attendance upon me? And why does he not lay his full report before me? Had this been done, I would long ago have delivered the kings of the Ammonites into the power of Zimri Lim. Now go, I send you. Thus shall you speak to Zimri Lim, saying, send me your messengers. Lay your full report before me, and then I will have the kings of the Ammonites cooked on a fisherman's stick, and I will lay them before you." That's the end of the quote. This is what this man saw in his dream, and then recounted to me. I now hereby write to my lord. My lord should deal with this dream. Furthermore, if my lord so desires, my lord shall lay his full report before Dagon, and the messengers of my lord shall be constantly on the way to Dagon. The man who told me this dream was to offer a pogrom sacrifice to Dagon, and so I did not send him on. Moreover, since this man was trustworthy, I did not take any of his hair or the fringe of his garment. So Ittur Asdu says that on the day he wrote this letter, there was this man from Shaka, a man called Malik Dagon, who came to him with the message. And Malik Dagon says he had dreamed in a dream of mine. I was set in going in the company of another man. In the dream, he and this other person went to Terka, that's a place near Mari, and to a temple of a deity by the name of Dagon. Probably the same as the Dagon mentioned in the Old Testament as the god of the Philistines. But the letter goes on to say, when Malik Dagon went into the temple, in his dream, the god asked him a question. Did the kings of the Ammonites and their forces make peace with the forces of Zimri Lim? There have apparently been skirmishes between the soldiers of Zimri Lim and this people called the Ammonites. And when Malik Dagon gives a negative answer, the god says, why aren't the messengers of Zimri Lim, why aren't they in constant attendance upon me? Why doesn't he give me a full report? Had he done that, I would have delivered these people, these Ammonites, into the power of Zimri Lim. And then he says, now go, I send you, thus shall you speak to Zimri Lim, saying, send me your messengers, lay your full report before me, and I'll have these Ammonites hooked on a fisherman's spit. So after Iturastu tells Zimri-Lim what this Malak Dagon had seen in his dream, he advises him to follow the instruction of Dagon. Now, some see in Malak Dagon an analogy with the prophets in Israel. And they set it up this way. Malak Dagon delivers a message from the deity that Zimri-Lim is supposed to obey. And the prophets in Israel often gave a message from the deity Yahweh to a king that he was to approach. However, at this point, I want to come back to this later, but at this point, I think it's worthy of notice that Malak Dagon does not do that directly. Malak Dagon doesn't go to the king. He gives the message to Iturastu, and Iturastu passes it on to the king by means of a letter, a tablet, writes it down, sends it to him. So there's some similarities as well as differences. Let's go on to text B, which is a letter of Kibri Dagon to Zimri-Lim. This is a I'm sorry, I said B. It is B on your outline, but in your handout photocopy, it is text E over on the next page, bottom of the first column. It's a brief text. Reads, moreover, the day I sent this tablet of mine to my Lord, an ecstatic of Dagon came and addressed me as follows. See this word Mahu? That's the ecstatic of Dagon. See there's a footnote there, 13. The term used is Luhum, that's a Mahu, another word. On the distinction between Luhum and the more common form outside Murray, Mahum, see Mahuma, and so forth. The translation ecstatic is based on etymology and general usage. But the Mari material gives no evidence of extraordinary psychic condition. But that's a use of that word. This ecstatic of Dagon came and addressed me as follows. The God sent me, hurry, right to the king, that they are to offer mortuary sacrifices for the shade of Yadu-Rim. This is what the ecstatic said to me. I have therefore written to my Lord, let my Lord do what pleases him. Now, Kibri Dagon, this is a letter of Kibri Dagon to Zimri-Lim, was the governor of a place near Maru. And he says this ecstatic came to him with this message. Right to the king there to offer the mortuary sacrifices for the shade of Yadu-Rim. The shade is the peace of the dead spirit. And Yadu-Rim was the father of Zimri-Lim, so the father of the king. And it seems that Zimri-Lim had failed to bring offerings for the spirit of his dead body. So Kibri Dagon gets this message from an ecstatic and passes the message on to the king. And you notice the last line, he advises the king, you should do this, but then he qualifies it, let my Lord do what pleases him. All right, C on your outline is a G on your handout. I won't read all of that. It's a broken tablet. There's a gap in the middle. And it seems to concern the message of an ecstatic saying that Zimri Lim is to bring an offering for the dead on the 14th day of the coming month. Maybe the same offering referred to in the previous text. But you notice how it answers it. May my Lord do what in accordance with his deliberation pleases him. And D on your outline is F on your handout. Another letter of Kibri Dagon with a reference to an ecstatic. See, this ecstatic came here earlier. But difficult to understand. It seems that the message concerns the building of a city gate. Exactly what is said about the gates, not so clear. Some say instructions are given for the gate to be built. Others say it's a warning not to build it, but it's an ecstatic. It was a message that is to be given to the king with respect to that city gate. All right, let's go on to E. Ooh, is this class up to Tetrasio? E, conclusion concerning the Mesopotamian analogies. There are books of literature and articles. And in that literature, many have argued that there are similarities in both form and content. Both form and content. Between the ecstatics of these texts and the prophets of the Old Testament. Now, let's look at some of this. As far as similarities in form, it's argued that just as the prophet in Israel received his message from the Lord, Yahweh, so in Mari, the ecstatic received his message from David. That's fair enough. It's a formal similarity. Secondly, as the prophet in Israel brought his message unasked with divine authority to the king, so also in Mark with this ecstatic, the message was sent on to the king, unasked. The king didn't ask for a message. There was no determining in advance whether the king would want to hear the message or not. He was given the message. So another parallel. And thirdly, just as the prophet in Israel was often critical of actions of the king, so here Mari with the ecstatic. There's criticism. Why didn't you keep me informed with the Eucharist? Why didn't you offer these sacrifices? We should have read. So those are what you might call formal similarities, similarities in form. What about similarities in content? Some have argued that in that first text, you find something comparable to a prophecy of deliverance in the Old Testament. In other words, if you had kept me informed, you see on 2, 4, 6 lines down, had this been done, I would long ago have delivered the kings of the Ammonites into power of Zimri Lim. So, a parallel to a prophecy of deliverance in the Old Testament. And a second similarity in time. Also from that first text, about 8 lines down. Now go, I send you, thus shall you speak to Zimri Lim. Similar to Jeremiah 1:7. You must go to everyone I send you to, say whatever I command. Now go, speak to Zimri Lim. So I think at that level, you can say, yes, there are some similarities between the Mari material, the Old Testament in form, and even some faint similarities in title. But having said that, I think it's very important the notice at the same time. There are also some very important differences. Let me mention a few of them. First, in that first text, Mount Dagon, who received that message, does not go directly to the king. He goes to one of the king's officials. He goes to Itur-Astu. And Itur-Astu puts the message on a tablet and sends it on to the king. So there's an intermediator, you might say, between the prophet who receives the message and the person who delivers it to the king is an intermediate. There's a third party there. In the other three letters, the ecstatic goes to Kibri Dagon, who passes the message on to the king in written form. So, in other words, in all these texts, the message gets to the king indirectly through a third party. It's customary for the Old Testament prophets to deliver their message directly to the king. One of the classic examples is Ahab, or Elijah, who confronts Ahab. No, he just goes out to him and confronts him. Or Isaiah, who goes out and confronts Ahaz. It's direct. Secondly, two of the tablets end with a rather striking statement. That first one, it's on your handout. It's E and G. E ends with the statement, "Let my Lord do what pleases him," after the message is concluded. And G, "May my Lord do what in accordance with his deliberation pleases him." So two of those tablets end with that kind of a statement. That kind of a qualification detracts from the force and the authority of the message. Here's the message, but do whatever you want. That certainly distinguishes it from the message of the Old Testament prophets. The Old Testament prophets never gave a message from the Lord with that kind of a qualification attached to it. Thirdly, the focus of the message in the Mari text does not concern ethical or spiritual realities, but only external cultic obligations. You know, offer this sacrifice. Give me a report about what's going on. The Mari text, the message of the Mari text, does not concern ethical or spiritual realities, only external cultic obligations. And that contrasts greatly with the message of the Old Testament prophets, whose primary concern was with the moral and spiritual condition of the king and the people. I want to elaborate a bit on that, but I'm already over time, so I'm going to have to stop. But let's pick up with that at the beginning of our next session and go forward from there.